position number 21877, wheel 6.
Crema, reel 6.
With this head, they put it amidst the flaming embers of a bonfire, and it bubbled away. Obviously, it must have been a delicacy. The white flags became more and more numerous, so did the prisoners. It's obviously a complete collapse of the German army. We eventually reached Wismar on the Baltic coast. Before we reached Wismar, we were supposed to stop at the River Elbe. That was the agreed demarcation line between the Red Army and ourselves. But the powers that be decreed that we should go over the river and advance still further eastwards. There was strange talk going on. We were first of all told not to smash the rifles of surrendering German troops, as they might be needed in case the Red Army turned nasty. I've never heard that before, and I haven't heard it since. But if Montgomery said, right, we'll have a go at the Red Army now, you know, to save ourselves further trouble, most of the army would probably have gone. But we reached the Baltic coast of Wismar, and then the war came to an end. We were struck by the amount of very lights and parachute flares and so forth, which went up over the Russian line. It was a very low-key affair, the surrender. It was nice to be able to sleep without anybody disturbing the slumber. Two or three things I noticed the day before the war finished. One was a German soldier dead in the middle of a bridge. And the next, after the war had finished, of a young German soldier of the Gross Deutschland Division lying all by himself, dead in the field, with a dew on his pale face. A very good-looking boy. He seemed to epitomise the stupidity of war. When I reached Wismar, I was told to take control of a large convoy of German civilians who wished to go back with us to the Elbe, away from the Red Army. This is an amazing thing. I drove a motorcycle at the time. I had an interpreter on the pillion. We drove up and down this motley collection of carts and old cars pouring back towards the Elbe. On our way over the Elbe, on our way to Wismar, we had to climb across the wrecked iron bridge. We got ourselves absolutely soaked because the bridge subsided just below the waterline. We managed to get the convoy back, and then we were able to rejoin the battalion and commence the journey back to England. This is done by the airfield. I don't know where from. And we landed at an airfield somewhere in England, not far from Netheravon. I brought back with me a sniper's rifle, as I said before, and a nice selection, a nice collection of armour to service, shoulder straps, skillet arms badges, and so forth. In connection with the skillet arms badges, when I went to the Imperial War Museum a year or two later, I made inquiries about the Sturmgewehr, the storm rifle, and they only had one in their store, and that was a curved one, which somebody had told them was used by the Germans to shoot round corners. I don't know whether this is true or not. I don't think a bullet would travel round a corner like that. And also, the skillet arm badge included one for 50-50 tank action. This was not in their collection, and I eventually disposed of it to a second-hand dealer of my thoughts. We lost an awful lot of men once again. By the end of the European campaign, we lost 190 men killed, which is pretty appalling. Although, of course, once again, we weren't the most heavily injured in the whole division. Some of the regiments had worse losses than we had. After we picked up reinforcements, we returned to our camp in Bulford, and were sent on embarkation leave because the war in Japan still had to be fought, had to be won. We returned from leave, issued with all jungle equipment, the new number 5 rifles, all our underwear was in jungle green as well as the uniforms, a new 1940s webbing, jungle green again. And I've only learned in the last 10 years that the plan was for the 6th Airborne Division and the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions to be landed across the Japanese line of retreat in Malaya, which would have been a pretty formidable task. Anyway, to cut a long story short, and thankfully, somebody decided to drop the atom bombs on Japan, and she surrendered. As we were fully mobilised, fully equipped, reinforced, the War Office didn't want to waste us, and they decided to send the battalion to Palestine, where trouble was brewing between the Arabs and the Jews. I was due at being age and service group 21, was due out of the army in December 1945. And I was in mixed feelings about that. So on our return from embarkation leave, the adjutant sent for me and said, "I understand you're due to leave us in December." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you're not too keen, are you?" I said, "Well, not really." He said, "You're not looking forward to going back?" I said, "No, not really." He said, "Well, no, you're acting sergeant major now, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, there's always chances of more promotion if you take advantage of this latest instruction." And he read me out the age and service, a deferment scheme whereby I could sign on for 1 or 2 years extension of my service without prejudice, which meant that my employer couldn't do anything about it. So without any more ado, I signed for another extension. I never told the police, although I promised them I'd be back in December. In November, we set sail for Palestine. We boarded the troop ship in Liverpool, and away we sailed to warmer climes. When we got past the Bay of Biscay, to my surprise, they instituted a system of compulsory sunbathing, which to me, a real sun worshipper, was a bit of a laugh, as apparently they didn't want our knees to be all white when we went into the new khaki drill. We landed at Haifa, and that on the shore waiting to greet us was the smartest man I've ever seen in a military-style uniform. He had an astrakhan cap, like a fez. He had a beautifully pressed khaki drill, navy blue hose tops, and navy blue puttees with beautiful shining boots. This was apparently a member of the Arab section of the Palestine police. We boarded lorries in Haifa and drove south towards Gaza. On our way through, before I go any further, on our way out, we first of all saw Gibraltar, and then on our way to Palestine, we saw Pantelleria, the Italian Howard Island, the Italian Gibraltar. It was absolutely pockmarked with air holes, damage, bomb holes, and then we went through the Straits of Sicily to Haifa, and on our way down south, we noticed a difference between the Arab settlements and the Jewish settlements, the latter all beautifully tended with orange trees and vegetables and fruit and so forth. And it's obvious that the Jews had done a very good job there. Now at this point, let me point out my situation. I've never had any animosity towards Jews in England. I was dreadfully upset the way they've been treated in Germany, and I straight away became very fond of the Jews, the good they were doing to Palestine. We reached Gaza, dug in the sand near a cemetery of the British troops who died under Allenby in the capture of Palestine during the First World War. We went through Gaza to the lovely seashore, lovely sand, and life was really, really pleasant until the Jews started to turn nasty, started shooting at British soldiers, killing some of them, ambushing some of the parachute regiment, blowing up railway tracks, and all in all made themselves a proper bloody nuisance. So we started to turn towards the Arabs, and the Arabs were very nice to us. They invited us to the Ramadan feasts and everywhere. And then we got to our station near Gaza, Mulkham, or some name like that. And then they started searching settlement, Jewish settlements for arms and things like that. By this time I was a paid sergeant major, company sergeant major. And I was in charge of the reinforcement company again. And then the heat was wonderful compared to what they were experiencing in England at the time. And then there's an advert on the notice board asking for the regimental sergeant major to be in charge of the newly set up 6th Airborne Division Training Centre at Hadera in North Palestine. I put in for it and was accepted. Left the battalion with my red beret. The battalion, the 6th Airborne Division, was disbanded at that time, except for the parachute people. And my 1st Battalion Royal Artillery Rifles had to give up their berets and were issued with a shapeless khaki cloth beret, and were sent to Jerusalem for garrison duty. So here was I with my nice red beret still. My lovely Far East style brown leather boots. The rest of the battalion had to blacken theirs because they were a rifle regiment. And there I was at Hadera, Lord of all I surveyed. It's a wonderful job. We stayed at Hadera for some time. The troubles were still going on. The Jewish people weren't very fond of us. I enjoyed Haifa and Tel Aviv and all the other lovely places in Palestine.
Was Hadera much affected by the troubles?
No, it wasn't attacked or anything. But at Hadera, it's a strange situation. The Royal Air Force were getting rid of all their pilots and navigators and air gunners, but rather than let them all flow out at once back to England to make a mess of the employment market, they were kept on in their ranks, but were given fairly menial tasks. Sometimes Hadera was a former airfield. So there was a warrant officer class one acting the duties of a post corporal, dealing with the mail and things like that. So they weren't very happy with the situation. They're still getting the same pay. The only precaution we had to take were to look after the lines, the all barbed wire around the Hadera, because the Arabs used to come in and try and steal washing off the lines. and the Arabs and the Jews would have liked our new number 5 rifles. So the bayonets were kept separate from the rifles and the bolts in another place. We moved from Hadera to Petah Tikva, and there was a very dangerous situation. Of course, unknown to me, the late Menachem Begin, I think his name was, who was the prime minister of the eventual Israeli government, was hiding in Petah Tikva, in a village just outside the station, which was another airport, another airline. But I had taught officers and NCOs and WOs how to become drill instructors and read military law and things like that. But drilling in the harsh sun was a very great ordeal. We used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, do a PT period, have our breakfast, then straight onto the airfield for drill in the blinding sunshine, which was not only up in the sky but also reflected off the white tarmac. Then we used to have a very light lunch at lunchtime, and then tiffin, another meal, at tea dinner time in the evening. You know, the Arabs were the cooks and Arab cleaners and so forth, and Arab hairdressers, watch sellers, everything in the station. They did everything. I collected a mascot, a tortoise, because the tortoise was wild in Palestine, Isabel, and eventually I got another tortoise. I didn't know the difference between male and female tortoises until one evening when it was half light. I was awakened in my quarters underneath my mosquito net by a knocking sensation. When I turned the light on, there was the new tortoise knocking on the back of Isabel's shell, and then he got on top of her shell and indulged in a bit of sexual intercourse, which was very educational. One evening, I heard a sound of gunfire, machine gun fire, and looked out and saw Tracer coming over the top of the camp. I rushed to the guard room, which was occupied by the 17th Parachute Battalion. A newly formed parachute battalion who come from the Far East, and found all the guard on the floor, the guard commander, and of course I had to appear brave and tell them off for not rushing out to find out where the machine gun fire came from. We sent out a patrol but found no signs of any shell cases or machine gun. We used to take our rifles with us to the beach at Jaffa, and all in all, even when you used to go to chapel at Sarafan, you used to be fully armed at all times. The situation wasn't very pleasant, although of course we all got an extra medal for that, the General Service Medal with Palestine. We didn't lose any men, but the cemeteries in Palestine were nearly full of people involved in the car in the road accidents because of the way the roads were built. Just a strip of tarmac, and if you put one wheel outside the tarmac, you ended up in sand and the vehicle usually overturned. The advice to us was, if you were driving and you hit a camel, was not to leave it there wounded, injured, but to, I'm sure somebody was joking, but to reverse over it to kill it, because it's much cheaper that way to compensate the owner than to compensate him for loss of earnings for years on end. Time came, this back end of November 1940, 6, and I boarded the train in Palestine to go to Egypt to pick up the troop ship on my way home. We were told not to let our hands dangle on anywhere near the window of a train, because these marvellous little boys, Arab boys, used to jump up and tear the wristwatch off your wrist. They also used to, like, when we went by in trucks and so forth, they used to lift up their gains, I've forgotten the Arab name, and say Shufti Zubrik, which means something rude, which cheer the troops no end. We ended up in a transit camp at Port Fouad, I think, just opposite Suez. We had to wait about a week for the troop ship to arrive in Port Said. And of course, we had hardly any money left. And there's no system to get more money as we left our units. So things weren't very good. Well, I was RSM, and I went out with a couple of sergeant majors, parachute sergeant majors, to Port Said on one occasion, over the ferry, over the canal. And we came back rather late, later than we expected. Then there's barbed wire around our transit camp, so we thought we'd go around the back and climb over the wire to get in, because we were about an hour adrift. As we climbed over, a torch was shone on us, and a chap in Africa Corps uniform, a German prisoner of war, with a pick half, challenged us. They were the ones looking out security, and they stopped us. "What are you doing coming in this way?" the chap said, in quite passable English. I said, "We're sorry, we're a bit late." "Why don't you come through the main gate?" And I said, "Well, of course, we didn't want to be found." He said, "Do you know Sergeant Majors?" He said, "I don't know how on earth you won the war with your state of discipline." We all had a laugh. We gave him all the cigarettes we had and went away chuckling. It was very cold. Don't forget, we left in Palestine. It was very hot. It was very cold with the wind. Eventually, our troops have arrived. We're WO Class 1. We had very good accommodation there. I felt sorry for the people, the ordinary swaddies, because they were right down in the bowels of the ship. We travelled across to Toulon, sailed between the masts of some sunken French battleships that had been deliberately sunk there by the crews at the beginning of the war, in the 1940s. Stayed in Toulon for about 2 days, and then caught the train all the way from Toulon to one of the channel ports, I don't know which one. When I got to the channel port, we were examined by customs, and I noticed, typical customs, no, when we got to Dover, typical customs, they checked the officers and the WOs, but never bothered about the other rank. So the time came for me to be inspected. They said, "Is that what's in this tip bag?" I said, normal clothing. "And what's this thing wrapped up in sandbag material?" I said, "It's my washing kit," not telling him that it's my hibernating Isabel, which I brought home with me, which was all forbidden in those days, and still is. Eventually got to some holding place in London, issued with my trilby hat and my suit and shoes, and that was the end of Kramer's military life.
So did you get Isabel into England?
Pardon?
Did you get Isabel into England without being confiscated?
Oh, yeah, that's the Dover. Well, not quite the end of my military career, because I still had about 4 years on Class A reserve, This is 6 pounds 17 and 6, a quarter. When I got back to the police, the chief constable never interviewed me, nor the assistant. And I was in disgrace, apparently, because I'd taken my time in coming back. A year and a half, practically. This is March 47. I returned to the force. Not much to say about the force. I applied myself diligently to passing my promotion exam. And after a long time, I became a sergeant in 1953, inspector in 59, retired in 65. As far as my reserve service went, about 1950 sometime, I received a letter from the record office, Army record office, to the effect there's a new Class A reserve being brought in. The new Class A reserve would get a slightly enhanced rate of pay, reserve pay, but I would be called up on any emergency short of general war. So I thought, well, shall I or shan't I? And I thought, well, I've taken quite a few chances in life. I think it's time to have a halt. So I didn't sign on. Fortunately, because a year after, the Korean War broke out, and all the Class A reserve were called up. And my battalion, the 1st Battalion Royal Ulster Rifles, ended up in Korea in the Commonwealth Brigade and suffered more losses there. So that was a let off. After a year or two, I was still a bit army-wise, so I put in and was granted a lieutenant's commission in the Army Cadet Force locally in the Hampshire Regiment. So I did one or two camps with them, and then, which meant that I came off reserve, and after about 2 years of that, I resigned and joined the human race. Looking back to Palestine with the Arabs, we get on well with them. One never to be forgotten occasion, we went out on an Arab chieftain's land with my PT instructor, who had a couple of shotguns and a 2-2 rifle. We had a wonderful day shooting pigeons, not as you're supposed to shoot them, on the wing, but off the branches, which is very unsportsmanlike. But the Arabs cooked them for us, and they're most unsatisfactory, so not much meat on them. The Arabs, on one occasion, at Christmas time, I think, we got a goose from the Arabs, and we got that cooked by the Arab cooks, who were very oily in their habits. And a goose came up, and we ate it, and I was sick about 2 or 3 days with a bilious attack. And for years I kept that enormous wishbone as a souvenir.
Could I ask you one or two questions about what you've already said, please? You talked about Hugh Weldon in the Rhine Crossing. Do you have any more memories of him?
No, no. No, I didn't.
No. Going back to the Royal Ulster Rifles, you said the attitude of civilians in Ulster towards soldiers in Warren Point was hostile. Why was it so negative?
Well, they were right on the border with the Free State. They were the same as Armagh now, you know, where there's a lot of Republican sympathies there. At Warren Point, too, it's my first venture into boxing, where there's a boxing tournament there in the railway station. And I was, had the honour of defending, first of all, battalion, then brigade at the cruiserweight division. And I managed to win on the 3 occasions or 4. But it wasn't a pleasant place, a soldier, and the same as today.
I think that you've got some comments you'd like to make about religious differences or communal differences in the Royal Ulster Regiment.
The When I joined the Royal Russell Rifles, I wasn't aware of any bad feeling between the Catholics and the Protestants, for which Northern Ireland is noted. But after a time, it suddenly emerged that although 6 days a week, shall we say, they're pleasant to one another,